Welcome to SLA, where you can learn to avoid gaslighting yourself and your language teaching practices,
break down academic gatekeeping on second language acquisition,
and girl boss your way through dynamic, engaging, and research-based language teaching.
I'm Ben Fisher Rodriguez, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Bill Langley, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Brian Smith, and my pronouns are he, they.
Let's slay. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Slay, second language acquisition for everyone. We are down a sick Brian. Brian cannot catch a break. So we are down a Brian today, but we are here to talk to you this episode about multi-word sequences. Ooh! A multi-word sequence is defined as a routinized string of recurring words that have frequently appeared together or are statistically strongly associated with each other. So we're here to talk about word language chunks, as it were.
I remember like when I was in undergrad and like first learning about language teaching, I just heard about chunks all the time.
Generally, the thrust of the article is that teaching language in chunks is generally a good thing. We'll get to kind of exactly how that is during when we ungatekeep the research. But what are some ways that you've gaslit yourself? In what ways has your instruction not been chunky and funky?
Yeah, well, I think that at some points it has been chunky, but not so funky, or vice versa.
Tell our audience more.
Yeah, so when I was reading through this article, what I kept thinking back to was how when we introduce vocabulary to students, a lot of times how we were taught as teachers was with vocabulists, or maybe we weren't taught that, but that was, we were given a textbook that just had a list of words. Maybe sometimes they included like an article or a preposition, which I'll touch on a little bit later, but they weren't useful language chunks. Like they didn't really do anything. So maybe a textbook in Spanish has tener, number, años, or to be an age or to have a number of years. And while that is a chunk, tener 15 años, to have 15 years, to be 15 years old, while that is indeed a chunk of language, it isn't as useful as things could be. So like because we don't say tener 15 años over and over and over, or that's not something that is explaining
very frequently.
Exactly. Like it'll happen, but it's not what students need in order to communicate something about themselves. So instead of maybe say like, if the vocabulist says tener años, maybe a better phrase would be tengo 15 años. So they just learned that phrase as a whole, which is a complete sentence. It communicates something about the person, and it takes minimal change to make it be personalized. So like, I'm not going to say tengo 15 años because I don't have 15 years. But for high school students learning a language, like that's going to be a really useful phrase for them. So one way that I think that I might have thought I was doing the right thing, but have learned better since, is the language chunks need to be something that is actually usable rather than something that students still need to pick apart, change around so that it works for them. If that makes
absolutely
sense.
I think when we teach those individual words, then students, when they're trying to compose their messages to us, like in the language but during communication, are taking apart those phrases in English word by word and then trying to look for the Spanish, the German, the French equivalent in the other, live and in the moment. And so, you know, that can lead to problems with word order and things that just don't make sense. And, you know, German is like English in that you say, I am blank years old versus French and Spanish, which say, I have this many years. And so, again, you get kids in the languages kind of doing the wrong things. I've had a Spanish speaker come into my class, actually, and say, I have 15 years in German because they were thinking in that sort of way. But I've also had, when teaching Spanish, kids, you know, I'm sure every Spanish teacher is nodding their head when they have heard soy quince años. And you're like, well, that's not actually correct. And we want them to be able to access those, like you said, the useful stuff, instead of to every utterance word by word, because that is also another great way to make using another language feel painful.
Right. Like, if you have to select every single word and are trying to make a one-to-one connection for everything that you want to say, that's going to, one, potentially, like, get you lost in translation. Like, in production and comprehension as well. Like, if we don't understand, like, what someone's actually trying to say, the article talks about idiomatic expressions a little bit, and idiomatic expressions don't translate word for word. It's not a one-to-one translation. For example, when I did my study abroad, I was in Costa Rica, pura vida, tomaticos out there, and I learned the phrase, which I learned later that it might have been a phrase that was more used by an older generation. So me as a 20-year-old sounded weird.
Talking like grandpa.
Yeah. So, like, there's the phrase, like, planchar la oreja. Like, literally, to iron the ear. But it means to, like, go to bed. Like, oh, I'm gonna go to bed. I'm gonna go iron my ear. And I said that once because it was a useful phrase. I didn't really have to change it. And, like, I just wanted to say, like, I'm gonna go to bed. And, like, my friends looked at me, we were like, where did you learn that? Like, are you staying with a grandma? Which, as I went on, I learned, like, more than just, like, abuelas say that, but it, you know, just a little bit of a generational difference. But I didn't have to think about when I was saying the phrase plan, like, I wasn't thinking iron ear. I was thinking I'm gonna go to bed. Because, like, that's the meaning that it carries. So that might have also actually been the way that I learned the word to iron, but that's, like, beside the point.
I think the focus on individual words, like, where we want our students to get is the fabled, you know, like, the dreaming in the language, the reading without
being
translating
funny.
Every single word. Yeah, being the funny. We want them to, like, have that, the fluency, right? Be going back and forth to kind of eventually get their brain into whatever mode. And I think that teaching words, you know, makes it, like we said, it just kind of makes it this game of, like, switching out this word or that. When really, like, when you and I are talking right now, I'm gathering groups of words and using gathering words as, like, an unusual phrase. So, like, my brain just had to think extra hard of, like, what I was saying. But I'm, like, gathering groups of words and using them all together in these, like, linked structures more than they are individual words that I'm thinking about to use to express what I'm thinking. And we want them to get that way in their production of the L2, but we don't do that through individual words. I think that the, like, individual words teaching also speaks to me, immediately puts me into traditional teaching methods and not teaching for proficiency and not using something, an approach like CCLT or whatever it may be, kind of in the proficiency vein. Because, yeah, it is determined by a textbook that is not really informed by how brains acquire languages. And it says to me that kids are receiving messages in individual words instead of receiving contextualized messages. But the way that students are going to understand intuitively grammar and understand intuitively what word belongs where is by hearing lots of language, like contextualized, comprehensible language, by reading lots of contextualized, comprehensible language. And a vocab list just doesn't count. Like, that does, it just doesn't have the same interest. It doesn't have the same kind of necessity that makes you want to read it. And so you're going to get less acquisition out of that list anyways. It just doesn't stick. And we want them to develop that sort of intuition that something is right or wrong based on the ear that they've developed, their internal ear that they've developed by listening and reading a bunch. I think people can do things with vocab lists, and if I tried to pretend over here that I've like never given a vocab list, that would be a lie. But I think that when that is our focus, and when we think about vocabulary in this way, and we try to get our students to think about vocab as these just lists of isolated words, then we're doing a disservice to ourselves and them by putting our teaching into that mode that just isn't as effective for a lot of reasons.
So something that reminds me of, like, I've had students throughout the years that have said, oh, like, I want to do some more independent study on my own or like at home, 'cause like I don't give formal homework. So students sometimes are like, oh, like, what can I do? Like, so I try to give them some suggestions, which we can talk about some other time, but what I've heard kind of frequently from students is that, like, oh yeah, like, I just want to take whatever we read in class and go home and just translate it. And what like the problems that come up with that, it are like, well, not every group of words needs to be translated word for word. And we almost kind of see that a little bit with, like, in Spanish at least, like the phrase me llamo, I call myself, the literal translation, like I said, is I call myself, but sometimes we tell students it means my name is. So once students learn the word for is, they think me, my, llamo, name, is. So we're giving them chunks sometimes, but I feel that if we're not giving them what it actually means and giving them like a literal translation versus, I don't know, an everyday translation, I guess, that is going to put things in the wrong parts of their brain. Like, if they're connecting me with my and Yamo with name, then that might cause issues with comprehension or production later. I think the same would go for in Spanish, the verb that we teach as to like. So, like, gustar doesn't literally mean to like. It means like something is like a pleasing experience to me. I try not to say like I'm not gonna, if maybe we in everyday speech translate to I like apples. But if we take it literally, that apples are pleasing to me, like, that's not how we talk in English often anyway, especially not for teenagers. Like, oh,
Hello.
this apple pleases me, or whatever. Like, we just don't, we don't talk that way. So we try to translate things, or we try to establish meaning in like student terms, but that's not always like how we actually need to explain the term, if that makes sense.
Students need to know that language exists in a variety of contexts and used in a lot of different ways, and that is through exposure. I've been thinking about how
Robust exposure.
robust, even,
Robust
is
exposure.
that if my students get too hung up on translations, it means that I've been doing a lot of translations in class. Like I do choral translations of texts that we've written together or that we're reading together, but if I find that if I do too much of that, then kids get really hung up on individual words a little bit more. Where I think if there are other ways that I can get them to show comprehension through drawings, through gestures, through, indication of yes or no, or like, sorts of voting with their bodies or so, any sorts of ways that we can check for comprehension, that they're getting more holistic language and not getting bogged down by the individual words, which is where I would want them to get eventually.
Right. And question real quick about that. Like, do you think that, which I know that what this article says, so I'm gonna like ask first, if like, I understand that, like, it's really easy to tell students, me gusta means I like. And then we throw an in on if we, I like more than one thing. But, like, maybe there's a question on, like, when or is if there is a point in which we circle back and say, like, ooh, actually, here's how this works. Now that you've been using it, now we can correct it a little bit. Or at least I can maybe try to make you a little bit conscious of, like, what it means if you say this versus what you say, what it means if you say this. So even, like, maybe establishing meaning of student production, I guess. And do you think if there is, like, a certain point at which we should be moving towards something like that? Like, if I teach in Spanish 1 on day 1, me gusta, do I go back a little, like, halfway through the year and be like, hey, you remember when I told you on the very first day that me gusta means I like? Well, it's not exactly that. Let's deconstruct it a little bit, or, like, let's give, or maybe at me as the teacher, I'm going to give a lot more examples of I like a plural thing versus I like a singular thing, or we like something, whatever, all that. Like, is there a point that we start talking about that, or at least make, I guess, pop-ups? Like, when do we just start doing pop-ups on those kinds of things?
I wonder if it's one of those things where we forefront the, it's almost like when we talk about quotation marks teaching grammar and comprehension-based teaching, is that the end quotes, is that the students need robust exposure to the language and context before you can contextualize any discussion of how form works in a language.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if that is, again, just like a matter of feel, where either the students start asking questions, or
right, which is you a know great time they, to answer them.
Yes, absolutely. Or you have given so much input on certain structures or certain constructions, like you said, like me gusta and whatever it is, right, and that they have been understood in context and you're certain of that, that once you feel that the students are confident with it, then you could go back and maybe break it down. Well, and even in, like, me gusta, they're going to see me in other, right, as a, like as a pronoun in other situations. And so that is going to come up, and maybe that will pique their curiosity. There was, like, oh, it was when he gave me something, I used that same word that I used in me gusta. Right. So, I'm wondering if that, again, is just like a matter of feel for us as teachers about our students' level of comprehension and, like, how acquired those things feel when we make the transition to being a little bit more analytical and comparison-y with the language. Because my thinking is, at first, like, yeah, like, right off the beginning, I want the conversation we have to be like, my name is so-and-so. What's your name? Oh, your name is this. Hey, everybody, so-and-so's name is this. Is so-and-so's name this, or so-and-so's name this, right? Like, lots of so easy, digestible language right at the beginning and immediate feelings of success. And I would worry that, like, if it was like, hey, when I said that, it, like, and immediately into grammar explanation, that it almost like is like, has like a dampening effect on motivation, or it just breaks the flow a little bit more when we can circle back to that later, as it were.
Yeah. And also, like, something to keep in mind is, like, sometime going back to, like, students ask questions, like, oh, that shows me that they're moving past just meaning. Like, they're getting the meaning, and now they have freed up, and they understand it so well that their brain has freed up space for them to pay attention to something else. If that's something, students notice something, I explain it, I can't expect them to just get it right, because they still have to process it. They might just be a little bit more conscious of what it is that they're saying, or of what they're trying to say, but it doesn't, just because I've explained it doesn't mean that they're going to fix, I'm putting that in quotes, fix, like, a non-normative language structure.
Sure.
So, all right. We've
been talking about, like, parsing
these. I know, so many.
Yeah, we've had, like, tearing apart these individual phrases. And so maybe now we Because the point is that this article is about multi-word sequences, MWSs.
Right. And let's dive in.
Keep this article for us.
So the article that we read for this episode is titled "The Role of Multi-Word Sequences in Fluent Speech, The Case of Listener-Based Judgment in Second Language Argumentative Speech." And this is in Studies in Second Language Acquisition. Great journal if you're able to access. It is by Kotaru Takizawa and Shungo Suzuki. So right off the bat, multi-word sequences, kind of touched on that, what that means already. But like, if you've got a single word, obviously that's not multi-word. So we just jump up to the two-word pairs. And so those are called bigrams. And the study also looked at trigrams. So two-word groupings and three-word groupings. And so to start off, like the authors talked about the perceived fluency and usage of multi-word sequences. So as you might be able to imagine, if you give a student a multi-word sequence like me llamo, and where they don't have to break down the different parts of the phrase, and we're just told, like, we use me llamo when you're introducing yourself. Me llamo Bill, me llamo Ben, me llamo Brian. How that might be perceived by a listener, which could you help me, like, help remind me of who they were asking to, like, do the perception of fluency?
Their readers were also L2 learners of English, but that were perceived to have the higher proficiency level, so that the study subjects were kind of in the B1 neighborhood in the CEFR ranking system, whereas the raters were trained teachers who were like PhD candidates and had taken courses in linguistics and were giving a training course. But their linguistic skills were rated closer to like a C1 level. And so that's like a major step up in like closer to native, like in quotation marks, production or, you know, standardized production than the learners who were the subjects of the study. But that also, they mentioned that as part of the limitations is that it was more, you know, this was a L2 learner judging an L2 learner. And there might be different perceptions if like an L1 speaker of a language was judging an L2 speaker of a language. So just a thought, an aside.
So some things that they looked at were like speech rate. So if we're able to pull out these like two or three word phrases and like they communicate a thought that we have, like we're going to be able to spit that chunk out pretty quickly because we've already got it in our head. So it could improve like the perception of speech rate. So if you don't have to stop and think, what is the next word that I'm going to say, but you've got a chunk of words that you can just say like off the, like, I don't know, off the cuff. That's the phrase. Thank you. I didn't have
that's a trigram
sequence. Yeah, that is exactly. So, and I did not have that multi-word sequence ready to go. But that's one thing that they looked at. Like, if you're able to say things quicker when it is a chunk of language. It also, they looked at pause frequency. So, again, if we have these ready-to-go phrases, we probably don't have to pause as frequently to think about what the next thing that we want to say. They also brought up self-repair. So when you do make a mistake, or I'm saying mistake, even though I've got thoughts on what a language mistake is, check out T with BVP or Talking L2 with BVP. They had an entire episode on if errors are even real in language learning, but like being able to fix, like if a student says, I'm going to keep going back to like me llamo or whatever, but if they intend to say me llamo, but they say me llama with an A at the end, having this chunk of language in their head, they'll be able to like repair it. They'll be able to like self-correct and be like, oh no, me llamo, and keep going on. Like I was just talking to students earlier this week about how, like, I want to get you to the point where you know what sounds right. Like, but in order to know what sounds right, you have to have a lot of input so that you're like, oh, I've heard these things before, but I've not heard them in that order, or I've not heard them in that construction before. So that it, like, helps students when they're talking with someone else, like, understand what is or is not common speech. So in that, when people are using these multi-word sequences, it improves their perceived fluency. It makes you sound more fluent if you can just rattle off some things. And another one in Spanish anyway, is like de vez en cuando, like from time to time. If, like, I don't know if I've ever, I mean, now that I'm like a fluent speaker of the language, I know what every single one of those words mean. But if I were to, again, if I were to translate it literally, it's like from time and when, which is, again, going back, it's not a one-to-one translation, but, like, if we have the meaning, then it doesn't matter if it's a one-to-one translation, because we know the message that we're trying to explain, and we get our message across to our other interlocutors. Multi-word sequences also help. It mirrors native speaker patterns. So there's so many things that we say every single day that are chunked language. So, for example, idiomatic expressions. Like, I even saw this, like, today in class. We're watching Pan's Labyrinth in Spanish 4. Great film. Make sure that it's an appropriate film for you to show at your school. But it's a great film. And the word to heal came up. Like, to heal someone is sick, heal them. Or someone has an injury, heal them. And I know that you've brought up before maybe, like, using passwords in class. And I have as well. One of my phrases this year was sana, 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 colita de rana, sino sana soy, sana ras mañana. Heal, heal, little frog tail. If you don't heal today, you'll heal tomorrow. So, like, I know if I hear someone say that, like, I know that I don't have to think about every single word in that. I know that they're wishing me well. And so when you can rattle off something like that, it shows, like, it gives you, like, some idiomatic expressions or other communication strategies that native speakers use. And they do talk about how, like, for beginners, like, basic collocations, like, me llamo, me, what's something in French? Or German, sorry. Brian's not here. What's something in German?
I was like, I immediately was ready, though. I was like, j'aime, like, I like, right? Like, yeah. Yeah. Or like,
je m'appelle.
You know, je m'appelle is a great one, because it's the same thing I call myself. Ilia. Just like for Finnish.
Yeah.
Yep, there you go. German, like, es gibt is there is or there are, but it literally means it gives, which my kids are always like, it's giving.
It's giving.
And I'm like, please, stop it. Yeah, but those phrases, like, you just kind of have to, like, I can't be like, escape means it gives, because then, again, right. Like, I don't know, you for our listeners, if you're not aware, that is a, you know, colloquial thing to just describe how the vibe that something is giving. So, you know, I think if I taught it in that way, it would be funny and memorable, but I think it would accidentally, you know, if I was like, oh, escape means there is a library. But if I taught that kind of in the English way, they're like, it's giving library.
It's giving library.
No, I'm not trying to say this room is like a library. I'm saying this room is literally there is a library at our school. So, yeah, the like literal or, you know, like colloquial translation and stuff like that. It's important to kind of be very clear.
Also, something that just, like, with your example there, something that, like, clicked into my mind was in Spanish, the phrase there is I. Just one word. And I see students, like, kind of go in reverse from, instead of from, like, Spanish to English, English to Spanish. Like, I see a lot of I es for to say there is, but I'm like, oh, that would just mean, like, there is, which is, like, that's just silly. I know what you're trying to say, but I get, but it is what it is. And then, so for beginners, like some basic collocations, basic grouping, basic bigrams, trigrams. And then the article talked about in for more advanced learners using idiomatic expressions. So like sana sana colita de rana, and or no hay mal que por bien no venga, like which the English thing version of that translation, I guess, would be something like every cloud has a silver lining, but like the literal translation for something good comes from bad things. Like anytime there's something bad, something good will come. And again, you don't need to understand every single word of that to be able to learn that phrase and learn the sentiment behind it, which is going to, one, lead to you sounding more fluent, but also being able to use those kinds of phrases, it's what is going to help students that are already performing maybe at like, I don't know, intermediate low, intermediate mid, is using these extended collocations, these idiomatic phrases are what, and like sounding, I'm putting this in quotes, sounding more native like is what's going to help them get a better rating on like a proficiency test. Like I know with Stamp, being able to use idiomatic expressions and cultural language, it shows a deeper understanding of the language that you already have. So if I know that this phrase that doesn't exactly translate works in whatever context I'm writing about, and whoever's rating my writing or speaking or whatever, it's going to demonstrate to that person that not only do I understand how to put language together, I also understand that I need to add something to my language to really demonstrate that not only do I know how to translate words, but I can like share my heart in the language. Which I am going to say, Dr. Bruna, she's at Michigan State, she had posted on social media a while ago about like artificial intelligence, AI. She had posted on social media about how like, you know, AI can translate for us, but it can't really like help you speak to someone's heart. So like it doesn't, translators in general as well, like don't understand sentiment of what we want to say. So by using some of these like multi-word sequences, we can take all of like the meaning that we have, that we want to communicate, and share it succinctly in a culturally appropriate way. And I think that's just real cool. So long story short, these like groupings of phrases or groupings of words can help students communicate more easily. It can help them be perceived as more fluent. And when you're thinking about how to organize like the vocabulary that you're giving to students, see how you can put some words together that are like natural combinations that will be used over and over and over.
What I appreciate about this is that, you know, it kind of laid out what fluency is that there's fluency of they use a model from Sigalovitz, which there's fluency of the utterance, there's cognitive fluency, and then perceived fluency. So utterance is just literally how quickly are you getting the words across your lips? What sort of pauses are you taking? That sort of things. Cognitive fluency is then like how you're processing the language, like how quickly it's moving through your brain and through the brain of your listener, that sort of thing. And perceived fluency is then somebody else is listening to you. Do they perceive that you're fluent? And what does that look like? And that the kind of in the literature review was helpful and interesting for me to see that yes, like most of people's perceived fluency is based on their rate of speech. How often do they stop to take pauses, and how many words can they get across their tongue in a certain amount of time? And so what was cool is then when you have this study, they controlled for the rate of speech because they were like, yeah, we understand that if people speak faster, people perceive them to be more fluent, just as like fluent as an idea. And we know that that is the biggest component of their fluency score. So they controlled for that and said, okay, we're going to take people who are saying roughly the same amount of words at the same time. You know, we're going to put their kind of samples next to each other, but then compare who was using more of these bigrams and trigrams, which again are two-word phrases, three-word phrases. You know, even the example that they gave is like, agree with is a two-word phrase that you can just say as a thing. So I agree with the speaker, but if you said, I agree the speaker, even with the same speed, it might sound less fluent. And I think, you know, in Spanish, estoy de acuerdo, like this, that's a phrase if you can just get, I agree, I am in agreement with, I am of the agreement.
In concordance with.
Exactly. Yeah. That if you, that speed is rate of speech kind of neutralized. It's the people that are using that these more, like you said, native-like connections, these more native-like groupings of words that are getting perceived as being slightly more fluent. And so, you know, fluency is one of those things. It comes up in my class all the time, like, how do you know when you're fluent? What do I got to do to be fluent? What does fluency look like? And I think when we're teaching in a communicative way, we need to like be able to put markers on our students' path of like, you fluently communicated your age, you know, like you fluently communicated your likes and interests and who's close in your social circle, that sort of, you know, whatever it is. Like we need to put those markers on there. But, you know, kids are also competitive with themselves and want to put little, you know, these kind of, they want to speak faster and speak more words and all these sorts of things. And so if we can give them these phrases, it's nice also to just pump them up with like, yeah, and you sound like a native speaker, like you sound like a German, or you sound like an Austrian when you say, you know, when you say es gibt blah, 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 and then like rattle off a list of things versus like stopping and being like, a lot of my kids have hit me with like the der ist, which is just the is. It doesn't even make sense in German, but it's because they're like English braining it still. But once they get like es gibt as a construction, then they can rattle off lists of stuff like all the time. And so, yeah, we want them to speak faster. Like that is a huge component of their fluency. But what if you neutralize for that? It's the people that are using these natural groupings of words together. And again, it's even as small as groupings as two and three words that are making these speakers come across as more fluent to the person listening to them. Another part that was interesting to me that I enjoyed reading was about that because your brain, it's not necessarily just access one word at a time when it's communicating. Like we're not just going doop, doop, doop. We actually are activating pathways of multiple words at the same time. When you're learning these groups of bigrams and trigrams or longer phrases that just kind of go all together, like de vez en cuando, like that sort of thing.
Quadgram?
When you're accessing, quadgrams?
Sorry.
But like that when you're learning those, you're learning that as like one thing. So you're not learning four things, you're learning one thing. So when your brain is accessing it, it's not using energy to access four things. It is using the energy to access the one thing.
Yeah, lowering the cognitive load.
When you lower their cognitive load, they are feeling more fluent because they're, again, accessing one thing versus four things and not struggling to pull each word out. But then the person listening to them, cognitive load is also reduced because they are hearing the group, which to them is also one thing. They're activating networks of language versus, again, trying to pluck individual words out, which have been learned kind of in isolation. And so they exist in isolation in the brain. And so it's a processing advantage for the speaker, but also for the listener. And so I think, again, that speaks to like the power of teaching these words that go together. Because they are learning them together, they are then accessing them all together.
I'm wondering about from the production side, we see that it's easier to pull out these two, three, four word groupings and just like spit them out. But I'm also thinking about how much, I mean, you've already said this, I'm just restating, I guess, but like, it's easier to guess what's going to come next. When you're listening to someone, when you're reading something, it's easier to guess what comes next. It's easier to have like a little bit more context when you're like, oh, I know this whole phrase already. So like, it's easier to just like which, good thing, bad thing, I guess, like, it's easier to just, like, skim over. Like, if it looks familiar enough and it and the meaning works, it's easier to go on to the next part that maybe you isn't as clear. But then your brain has the power to think a little bit more about it. Like, taking apart the individual parts of individual pieces of the word, the morphemes, if you will, and be like, oh, that goes there, that goes there, that goes there. And all of those things are connected, and now I know what it means. And so I don't know. I would be interested in, like, a further study about what learners guess would come next, I guess. Like, if you give learners, like, the start of one of these multi-word sequences, like, what do they think is going to come next? Or something like that. But that's just my teacher researcher brain. Just a thought.
If we know that teaching and learning multi-word sequences makes our learners be perceived as more fluent, then how can we go about doing that in instruction? How can we girl boss using those multi-word sequences in our fluent speech, Billiam?
Yeah, so one of the tools that I like to use, although, again, it's a tool, I use this from time to time, sentence builders, or you might know them as substitution tables. So in a sentence builder or substitution table, it sometimes looks like a bunch of columns. So I'm going to give a very, very rudimentary example, but maybe we can find a link to something to post in the notes. So maybe the first column has, like, subject pronouns. And I'll just do, like, a simple subject, verb, object. The second column has maybe different, just, like, so I'm thinking Spanish, like, come, I walk, hablo, I talk, I run. And then in the next column, it would be, like, con amigos, with friends, or solo, by myself, something like that. So, again, bad example, like a very rudimentary example, but the idea is that if you take something from the first column, something from the second column, something from the third column, no matter what it is in the list, it will make, like, a logical sense, or not, maybe not logical, but, like, grammatically correct sentence.
Yeah.
So what you can do in those is make it so that these word groupings have to go together. So we've already got columns, but then you start adding rows. So, like, you have to select something from each column, but then the rows have to line up. So maybe in the first column, in the first row, there's first column, first row, there's just the subject pronoun I. In the second column, first row, you got a couple different I forms of verbs. Again, that's for Spanish or some other conjugation languages. And then the third column, it would be, like, prepositional phrases, objects, adverbs of time, something like that, that could go potentially with just that first row, or maybe it goes with anything. So you have to take column one, row one, column two, row one, but then maybe column three, any of them can go with any of the other rows. And again, theoretically, makes a grammatically correct sentence. Now, what this does is it forces students to create grammatically correct sentences in a way that, like, lowering cognitive load. I know that these two rows have to have something in common, and then the third row, whatever. But then, for me, the magic comes from going from, again, like, individual words. So instead of just, like, first column being subject pronouns, let's just get rid of that. And in the second column, instead of, like, camino, put yo camino. So they have to use that chunk. And then that chunk has to go with whatever in the next column to make, again, grammatically, but perhaps not logically, comprehensible sentence. And if you use the, if you ever look into the Sentence Builder website, like, you can set these things up so that, like, say I do something that I've done this year is, like, medical recommendations. So I've got a headache. Okay. And then that might be, like, the phrase. That might be the multi-word sequence. I have a headache. Or, like, with subjunctive, like, I suggest that. Like, the that needs to go with it. So, like, if I'm trying to teach the students that, like, when you're giving suggestions, you need to have the word that in Spanish, even though we might not say it in English, just by, like, showing them in the sentence builder over and over and over that this word and this word have to go together, that's gonna, hopefully, I guess, I need to do more research into, like, what these, like, substitution tables or sentence builders, I need to do more research into them. I've only done them, like, practically, and they're fun. Like, I like them. I think I've seen some good results from using them. But, again, like, it's all about, like, patterns and making sure that the words that are supposed to go together actually go together. So that's something that I've done that I found to be at least, like, noticeably helpful.
I've seen that for German as well, and a lot of the times, like you said, the options that you're choosing from in any given column or row are not just individual words. So it'll be like, with my friends as a three-word phrase.
Yes.
With my family as a three-word phrase, right? And so I think that those can be helpful ways to model those, you know, phrases that they want to be able to whip out at any time. They don't want to have to be like, what's the word for with? What's the word for my? What's the word for, you know, they don't need to analyze it. They just need to be able to whip out the with my friends, with my family. And so I think, yeah, that can be a good way to model those, like, bigrams and trigrams. And so I've used those to a certain extent. And I used to use, you know, American, U.S. American listeners might be, you know, have seen a conference session or two about chat mats, which function in a similar way, right? Mm-hmm. Often you're getting
For sure.
Groupings of words together versus just one individual word. So it's putting language in context, like, here's how you might use it in a sentence versus in a very dry list that doesn't, you know, show usage, doesn't show real world communication.
Yeah.
I think another thing we can do to the service of our students is to teach them, like, fillers and repair phrases. Because even if, you know, if they pause and are trying to draw on their individual word knowledge to try to figure out how to say what they want to say, a simple way to make them perhaps feel more fluent and then again to look more fluent is just to teach them the little, you know, o sea, or the, you know, I've been thinking about, or I wonder if, those sorts of phrases that we use when we're buying ourselves time and are thinking, even in our L1, to buy them time, but also it's something that they can access as a phrase quickly when they maybe do need to think a little bit more thoroughly about what's they're trying to communicate and what's coming next. So those filler and repair phrases.
In Spanish 4, we're really trying to get pues.
Yeah.
Pues. Pues. What else?
And I tell my students else? I tell my students also too, like, I do rejoinders in class, which are just, you know, short, useful phrases that, you know, people pop into conversations as a way to show agreement or disagreement or express frustration or concern or doubt or all sorts of things. And again, they're, you know, something, it's something like, no me digas, like, don't say, or how nice. These are the sorts of things that if you're popping into conversation, I tell my students, you sound so German, you sound so Austrian. That can be a way, you know, increased perceived fluency, but also give students a way to contribute to conversations if they're not ready to contribute full sentences right away, or if the, you know, the conversations, as they do, go by so fast, like, they can still be a part of them and be understanding, and maybe, you know, when they have time to speak for themselves can do that, but they can just interject with these short memorized phrases. And I use them in the classroom as, like, they are posted on my wall. I teach them explicitly. We review them over and over again. But I've also used them as classroom passwords. For instance, the phrase, in my opinion, in German is so silly. It's meiner Meinung nach, which literally means my opinion after. So, like, it's just like, oh, God, like, it's so terrible to try to teach individually. But if you can just get the kids saying that phrase over and over again, then they're whipping that phrase out in their speaking and writing because it just came as a group and you don't have to teach.
Yeah.
Because I've also had students try to go the other way around and try to do in meine Meinung, which is like not quite as, it's not idiomatic. So, you know, getting those phrases and teaching them just as memorized phrases, as groups, however you have to. I use the ones that, when I have memorized phrases that I have a hard time teaching in the classroom, I just make it into a password for the class so that the students have to say it to me before they come in. So that way they have to retrieve it frequently every day for at least a week. And when we review them, I can say like, hey, look at all these passwords are helpful things to throw into any conversation. So that can be a way to teach those sort of phrases that are fillers or repair or easy to throw into sentences.
And then one thing that I was reminded of as you were talking about rejoinders is something that I've done recently to girl boss some of these MSs is I went onto Canva without the S, not the learning management system, but the design software. And I just created like these like 2x3, maybe not even that, little cards that have, I made three different cards. So in my classroom, I've got things of chairs and threes. So three different rejoinder cards, I made three different cards with a different list of rejoinders on each of the three. So in each set of three, there's say like 18 different rejoinders. And I just took some packing tape and taped them down onto the desk. So students have those rejoinders and a variety of rejoinders just ready to go at any given point, but they only have like six in front of them. But I do change seats enough that students get at least exposure to the different sets of rejoinders. And then because I started this at the end of the year, I haven't done this yet, but my hope is to maybe every quarter or at the semester change out the rejoinders on the desktops so that when they just look down, like, and I tell them like use these phrases, like, one, you're going to sound real cool, because like my favorite one that I've got on there is like from Puerto Rico, huepa, huepa, which I translate because of Justin Slocum Bailey as wowie zowie. And so like, that's like a really fun thing to use. And to like embed that with like TPR, like instead of a total physical response, it's like a total verbal response. So like the other day in Spanish one, we learned the phrase to have fun. So I told students like every single time that I say the phrase to have fun, you need to say wepa and like sound like you're having fun. And that showed me that one, they're hearing the word and hopefully like connecting the meaning with something like energetic. And then just randomly I said the phrase to have fun and a student with zero prompting just shouted wepa. It's been a couple days since we did that. It just like automatic. It was a lot of fun.
Yes. So, I've been thinking, I went to a session with Paul Aslison, who is the Montana Language Teacher of the Year a couple years ago. And one of his phrases that I was like, oh my gosh, why haven't I been teaching this, was schon wieder in German, which is like, it literally means already again. So it can either be like yet again or kind of like not this again, sort of. And that is another one that my students have weaponized and use all the time. If like something weird happens in my classroom, which it often does, they're just like, not this again. And I'm like, that's fair, drag me. But I think my final like girl bossy thought is how we plan and teach. Like, we need to be looking ahead to the sort of communicative demands that we want to make of our students. So we need to think about what we want them to express or interpret in terms of meaning, and then provide vocabulary that's presented in such a way that it's immediately useful for them for the purposes of those communicative goals. Like, again, if we want to be able to describe people, we need to have words in describing language in useful forms for that sort of thing. If we want to express opinions, we need to have expressive opinion language that is in the form that you're going to say it in or that you're going to write it in. And so having those phrases, you know, instead of, you know, listing the infinitive or listing, you know, single words, just having a set phrase already conjugated, whatever. And then if, you know, should a word come up in a different context with a slightly different conjugation, different subject, whatever it might be, you can sometimes just, you know, activate that in the student's brain just by saying the original phrase that they learned in like the context that they learned it, and then just kind of changing, you know, transferring the context. And so I think that we need to think ahead of like what we're going to ask our students to do and then make our, you know, vocabulary presentations, however, if it's through stories, if it's through PQA, if it's through, you know, pictures and sorts of things, we need to make those thinking of how we're going to be asking the students to process the language, but then also how we, in this unit, in this instructional sequence, want them to then use it. And so we need to be able to present it in that way. And so it takes a little bit of forethought of, you know, like, you know, I need them to be able to make medical recommendations, like you said. So I need to have my opinion phrases conjugated probably to the yo form, to the I form, because it's you giving the opinion. So you don't want to give them opinar que, you give opino que, I am of the opinion that, you know, those sorts of things. So using that as a planning consideration to get these useful multi-word phrases, multi-word sequences, just so easy to access because they have been presented in the way that we're going to use them. We've used them then in that way, and to build that fluency and build that sense of accomplishment for our students, because that's what we want. Anything left, Diva girl?
Not for me. I will say that it has been sad to not have Brian with us these past couple episodes, but I'm glad to talk with you, and hopefully our next episode, which, I mean, what is this, episode 18?
It will be episode 18.
Yeah, we've got two more left, and then we're going to take a break for the summer, right? Yeah. Seems like the plan. So we look forward to connecting you all back with Brian in the coming weeks. And until then, get out there and slay.
Bye.
Bye. Oh, one more thing. Over the past year, I have been doing the Actful Parent Share, which is a program that they do to connect mentors and mentees. And I have really dropped the ball these past couple episodes because my parent share partner, Elizabeth, has been asking me to give her a little shout out. So I have not. She says she listens to us every single time an episode drops. So shout out to Elizabeth. And the word that she's been wanting me to say was cat. So she wanted me to send a little signal to her. So I think this explicit mention of her name probably is a little bit better than saying the word cat. But hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, girl. Hi.
And slay.
Slay greets you. Okay, go forth and slay. Bye.
Bye.